Hello, this is Kirsten Ellsworth, and I am the host of the New Books in Art channel for the New Books Network. Today, it is my pleasure to have Dr. Paul LaVallee speaking with us about his book, Art Follows Nature, A Worldwide History of the Nude, published by Edition One Books, Berkeley, California, 2016. And Dr. LaVallee, I would like for you to introduce yourself to the listeners and tell us a bit about what you do and how you came to this project.
Well, these days I'm retired, so I do as little as possible. But I was teaching Art of India at Florida State University and Interdisciplinary Humanities at Florida A&M University. And on the odd semesters when nobody wanted me, I substituted in a couple of the better high schools.
So you've worked with students of all backgrounds and ages, I'm guessing.
Well, high school on up.
Okay. And in your work, did you find that your students were interested in the history of the nude form?
Yes, students were interested. Always had to tread a little lightly, not to irritate administrators or parents.
Of course. And so your project, the book that we are going to speak about today, it began as a series of essays in a magazine called Naturally Magazine?
Yes. It's a nudist magazine. And for 20 years, I wrote the art history column. I hold the record for the longest running signed column in the history of the American Naturist Press.
And it's art and history, and as an art historian, I'm thrilled that that's the column that people really wanted to read every time the issue came out.
Yes, yes.
And what drove you to bring together the essays and create a book?
Well, the plan always was to republish them in book form. And it's a little awkward because on probably most of the columns, it's a snapshot of an age, say the Baroque period or something like that. But on other occasions, I would take a particular topic like Cupid or David and run it through time. So when it came time to put these all in a book, I had to make some decisions about where to put those wide-ranging chapters. And another thing, I decided as soon as I started organizing these, each article had a beginning and an end. And I didn't want to throw those away for the sake of making the book smoother. Besides, each article was written to give people something to think about for a few weeks. This is not a book that you speed read through from cover to cover. You need to set it aside. So I left it in that episodic form.
As a reader of the book, I think that's a very attractive feature because it is 572 pages, I believe. And
yes,
it's the book that you want to have, pick up, read, as you say, think about a certain time in history or follow a certain motif or type, and then put it down. And What a privilege nowadays when everything moves kind of quickly, we do things quickly. This is really a book for contemplation, I would say.
I hope so.
Definitely. I'm interested in one of the motivations you discuss in the book was a lecture by Kenneth Clark, the eminent Kenneth Clark, correct? In 1956, I wondered if you would explain to the listeners what he said and how you took his comment and really developed this project from the words he provided.
You're right. Clark's book, The Nude, began as a series of lectures, and then it was published in book form. And much as I like the book, I'm afraid that on page one, he said something pretty dumb. He said that naked people are pitiful things, but the nude, that is high art. And he made distinction between the naked and the nude, which is a distinction that exists in no other language. And it never existed in English before he made it. But for 60 years, everybody's been quoting Clark. And I just don't see the distinction that he's making. Yes, actual naked bodies can be beautiful, can be uplifting, can be all the things that nude art embodies. So in some ways, this is my quarrel with Sir Kenneth Clark. As far as I can see, a good share of the nudity in art reflects actual nudity in society. The artists were painting or sculpting what they saw.
I think your point is very persuasive. And with that backdrop of all the chapters we could discuss from this really thorough book, which is also lovely in terms of illustrations, would you speak about the Middle Kingdom Egypt period to help us understand part of your argument about the nudity and not the idea of the naked?
Yes, probably at this point I should clarify that the few other books on the nude in art usually have a little bit about Egypt, nice coverage of Greece, and then go to Europe. And that's it. This book spends a great deal of time on India, very little on China because there's not much there. A surprising amount of nude art from the Middle East, American Indians, Africa, plus all the traditional stuff from Greece and Europe. Now, concerning your Egypt question, children always went nude in Egypt through their 3,000-year history. You almost never see a child wearing clothes. From the beginning, we see farmers out working nude in their fields. Why get your clothes dirty? We see fishermen working nude around the water. It only made sense. And toward the end of the Old Kingdom and on into the Middle Kingdom, mid-level government officials started growing more and more confident and began putting nude sculptures of themselves in their tombs, as though to say to the gods, here I am, take me or leave me, I don't much care, I know who I am. Some amazing confidence we see in, through the first half of Egyptian history. Then when we get to the New Kingdom, it all reverses. They made the same decision that Western fashion makers made around 1800. They decided that women should look sexy, but men should not. And you see no more nude men in the art. And you don't see respectable women. The high-class women are wearing almost transparent gowns. The nudes we see in the New Kingdom are servant girls. And that continues until almost the end when they run out of ideas and start reviving some of the old ones. And they even bring back a few rare male nudes toward the end.
So it sounds like this change is connected to gender politics and class?
Yes.
It's so important to remind ourselves that these issues that are so interesting today are also present, of course, in the most ancient of times. I really like that about your book, that it's not a static presentation, as sometimes occurs when talking about, say, Egyptian art, ideas that the art never really changes much, except for maybe in one particular moment.
That's simply because we haven't looked at it enough to know the differences. Even the clothing styles change from dynasty to dynasty.
In terms of moving to a different part of the book, as I mentioned to the listeners, there's so much. Your section on Egypt, I think, is appealing for those of us who just like Egyptian art. But certainly India is central to your analysis. And I'm also wondering how often you have traveled to India, and I'd like to hear about your point that the nude body conveys spiritual ideas, or that the idea that the nude body conveys spiritual ideas has always been a challenge, as you say, in Indian art.
Okay, that's a whole bunch of questions. I mentioned China had almost no nudes in their art. Other cultures, Greece, Europe since the Renaissance, and India, have made the nude or the semi-nude central in their art. And most of the books talk only about Greece and Europe. India is the third great component. And it's been left out until now, and it shouldn't be. Spirituality. I could go into a long lecture on this. The goal of most of the Indian religions is a spiritual oneness with the universe. That's a pretty big concept. And so the teachers would tell people, now you have experienced something a little like this already. Think of physical oneness. Two people as one. Sex. We in the Christian tradition tend to think of sex as the work of the devil. But in India, they say this is a good first step of two people as one. You're on your way to becoming at one with other people, with other things, with the whole universe. And several Indian religions, when their holy men gave up worldly goods, they gave up everything, including clothing. The Jains are the only ones of that tradition who still exist. And their art is full of nude saints. And it's difficult to do in art. When you're speaking, you can talk about the body and the spirit. But if you're going to make a statue, the body has to be male or female. There aren't very many alternatives. And so this immediately introduces sexual possibilities, which is not the point at all. And so, Jain art, for instance, is ruled by lots and lots and lots of iconography, rules about how the body is to be depicted to give the aura of spirituality. And as a result, they tend to all look alike, so much so that they then have to put a little symbol under the person's feet so you know which one it is. Now, one of the most ingenious solutions I have ever seen is called the Jain Icon of the Released Spirit, which is essentially a vertical slab of metal, and the human figure is cut right out of it. So you're looking through it into the air. The body has dissolved into spirituality with the material world around it. Beautiful concept. Now, you asked several questions in there. Have I missed some?
I'm just kind of mesmerized by your description of that object. No, and
It's in the book.
it's just fantastic. And as I'm listening, I'm thinking of another section of your book where you bring in Saint Augustine and his idea of, the shame of the body. What a difference.
Between them, Saint Paul and Saint Augustine really did a job on Christianity. Both of them had hang-ups about their own sexuality. Augustine thought he was doing a virtuous thing when he abandoned the mother of his child. And somehow he became convinced that the sin in the Garden of Eden was sex. The Bible says absolutely nothing of the sort. And yet this was what Augustine was thinking. And he has influenced so much of Christian thinking that sex is just some terrible, terrible thing. And this book is not about sex. It is a nature's book. It's about nudity. Sex is rather irrelevant. It's certainly not a thing to be uppermost in your mind as it is in the minds of people influenced by St. Augustine.
Right. I think you make that very clear in the book, which is another layer in terms of the value of your work, in my opinion, and then as a reader. And this idea you mention also, this physical love versus a spiritual love in the Eastern context, correct? Would you
there
like
is
to...
no versus in the Eastern concept.
Right. Okay. So it's that's a Western vestige that seems to still remain. I think you have traveled in India and perhaps lived there. Would you like to speak with us more about your experiences there?
Well, I've traveled in more than 60 countries.
My goodness.
Most of it when I was young enough that I still had the stamina for it. Been to India a few times and gone to some of the very, very remote Jain sites of the Gomateshwaras. These are statues of a holy man. He and his brother pretty much controlled the world, or his brother controlled almost all of the known world, except the part that Bahubali owned. And he got jealous and he wanted that too. And Bahubali, being a nonviolent Jain, said, okay, we'll have three contests. A wrestling contest, a water splashing contest, and a stare down. And Bahubali won all three times. But he was so disgusted at his brother's greed that he gave him his kingdom, went off in the jungle, and meditated so long that vines grew up his arms and legs, birds built nests in his hair. And I don't remember why we're talking about this. It's a good story anyway.
It sure is a good story. Yes, and I think...
Oh, yeah, that's
yes.
Right. They put up these statues in several places in southern India. Giant statues. And some of them are out in the middle of swamps now and rather obscure places. And I've been to just about all of them.
My goodness. And this really, just as on a personal level, must be very powerful just to see what you're researching.
Oh, yes. Okay, we're going to be talking later about the Gymnosophists, but Greek proportions influenced some of Indian art, and it seems to have been carried on by the Jains. And so one of the things I was doing was measuring the proportions of those sculptures, not for this book, but for another book that I'm working on. And it was fine out there in the swamp by myself. And if the sculpture was in a museum or something, then all the school kids would start snickering as soon as I whipped out my tape measure and started measuring parts.
What a difference in contexts. Oh my goodness, yes. You're, as I understand what the Greeks called the naked philosophers, right?
Yes, Gymnosophists.
The Gymnosophists, aka the naked philosophers, they originate in ancient India, correct?
Oh, yes.
And we can talk about them now, or we can... Because it does seem like a good time. Would you like to explain more? Because it's a very important thread throughout the book.
Yeah. I got into this topic because of the Gymnosophists. They were my dissertation topic. And then I began seeing lots of other nude art and drawing conclusions, and that's how I got into this book. And I did not plan to have 100% done at the same time. But the magazine articles I mentioned were being done in Naturally Magazine, and the editor was planning to be the editor of the book also. He laid out chapter one, and he died. Not because of that. But suddenly, I had no editor. And so I made the rounds of all the art book publishers. Nobody would touch it. And so when I retired, I then bought a computer editing program and learned how to lay it out myself. And I'm really glad that I did, because there were a dozen or more decisions that had to be made every day about how big you make this picture, how big you make this one. I wanted to have the picture and the description on the same page.
Yes.
Or on the facing page.
Yes.
A few years ago, a pretty good book came out about nudes in American art. But somebody on the editorial staff decided it would look nice if there was one picture on every page, regardless of where it was discussed. You spent all your time flipping back and forth. These had been laid out well in the magazine, and I wanted them laid out well in the book, and I'm glad I was able to do that myself.
And it is a notable element of the book that when you are reading, you are looking. And that's very important in art history. That's a multi-sensory experience. If you can't actually walk through the swamps yourself, right? You need to have the visual and the text. I think that's very successful part of the book.
Yeah, I'm wondering about this podcast, how people hearing it only with no pictures in front of them, how much they're going to understand. Let me put in a plug right here.
Yes, I was going to say, will you let us know how we can buy the book?
I haven't put it on Amazon yet. So far, it is available only on my website, which is paullevallee.com.
Okay.
And Levallee is spelled L-E, not L-A. And one of the things on that website are a few sample pages you can actually look at and see the way it's laid out.
Having looked at the sample pages before I had the opportunity to read the entire book, it will lure you in. Those pages will lure you in. And I will also, for everyone who's listening, I will provide Dr. Levallee's website in the description, icon description on the New Books Network page, so that you can make sure you know where to go to purchase the book. Since we're on the topic of the Greeks, I wondered if you might discuss the athleticism and the Greek athletes and the subject of nudity.
Okay. First of all, let me state that for the last 22 years now, I have been running the College Greek Athletic near Monticello, Florida. It is the world's only authentically nude reenactment of the ancient pentathlon. So,
wow.
It's a lot of fun, and anyone of any age can compete, but the victory wreaths are reserved for the top college students. And the artists in Greece were watching the athletes, watching their every movement. And you can see the artists getting better and better and better as they observe how these bodies move. Athletics in Greece was very much a religious experience. The ideal was the well-developed mind in a well-developed body. And students would spend their morning at the gymnasium, which was an outdoor park. The word gymnasium, by the way, means place of nakedness. And in the morning, they studied music, mathematics, history, literature, all those good things. Then in the afternoon, they practice their athletics. And during the course of the afternoon, if a wandering philosopher happened to come through, they would take a break and discuss philosophy for a while. And all of this, the entire day, was done nude.
It's really a different image, obviously, than we have of the athletes today. And I'm wondering, in your games there in Florida, do you also have the element of the philosophical discussion?
No, it's just a one-day event.
It's the event.
We do briefly mention the things that I've mentioned here, but no, we don't get into philosophical debates.
I see. So, I know there's, again, I keep saying to the listeners, there's so many interesting topics I can assure you in the book. And if we may jump several centuries, I really wanted to hear about the depiction of the nude youth in the 19th century and the connection to the swimsuits. I think listeners will really enjoy this.
Okay, this is connected to ancient Greece. Out of Neoclassicism in the 1700s. They're digging up Pompeii and other places and rediscovering Greek culture. Western artists were kind of at a standstill. Nobody could make nudes like Michelangelo had made a couple of centuries earlier. Female nudes were becoming so commonplace that they were almost a cliche. But in the Greek art, they noticed a lot of boys. To the Greeks, it was like Texas, where football is the state religion. The Greeks loved their high school and college age athletes. And the early 19th century was very much an age of young people, poets like Byron and Shelley, in music, Chopin, all these people who burned themselves out at an early age. A lot of youth was in the air. So they came upon this new subject, the boy. It hadn't been done for a couple thousand years. And boys out skinny dipping, having a good time. You have to remember, this is the age of increasing industrialism. And the artists are thinking back to those innocent days of youth, sexually innocent and innocent, free from the machine age, when people were more natural. We had Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn. This whole idea got a boost in 1869 when some French fashion designer invented the swimsuit. No one had worn clothing before that when they went swimming. It was the looniest idea anybody could think of. But they soon got girls and women into swimsuits, and the women insisted that the men get into swimsuits. It caught on with women and girls. And then they got the men into swimsuits. Boys, they couldn't. The boys were out free in the woods. And to many people, this was fine because somebody was still free. Then in the 20th century, people started building indoor swimming pools, YMCAs, YWCAs, high schools. But the early filters would clog up on lint. And so the strict rule, absolutely no clothing allowed in the swimming pools. And the American Health Alliance did not lift that rule until 1962. And so there are a lot of people living today who remember swimming nude at the YMCA, swimming nude in their high school pool. It was just a part of normal growing up.
And I was thinking with your example of the power of your argument about the nude and the title of your book, Art Follows Nature. It's the natural state. And then I was kind of having a chuckle as a fellow art historian, thinking how exciting and intriguing your research, the twists and turns, and what you end up learning, about the history of swimming pools as you're studying your subject. Right. Also, I wanted to ask you about the art academies.
Art academies were a product of the Enlightenment of the 1700s. Before then, you became an artist by working as an apprentice under an older artist in his shop. But people of the Enlightenment were great believers in education. They believed anything can be taught, art can be taught. They believed very much that truth is eternal. Some of the ancient Greeks had discovered eternal truths. Other truths were being discovered by modern scientists. These were not new truths, these were ancient truths, but they were just being discovered. Truth is eternal. And so, this great belief in teachability, in the 1700s, art academies sprang up in several of the capital cities of Europe. And again, this is the time when they're digging up the ruins of Pompeii. So, in the first year, students studied basic forms, drawing circles and cubes and triangles and that kind of stuff. Second year, it was drawing the male nude from life. This they considered the foundation of all great art because it had been the foundation of Greek art. And for the better part of 2 centuries, that academic training prevailed to the point that we have lots of sketches by artists for paintings that they were going to do. And they would begin with the figures nude. And then they'd figure how the clothing draped on them. So this was the foundation of art from about 1700 till the Impressionists, who went outdoors and started trying to capture the shifting light, and there was no time to mess with all the refinements of the academies, and that was the end of the academies.
Can you imagine? I'm imagining without that shift, how different art would be today. And I know that you have some interesting rejection letters that came when you sent your book out. Would you like to share some of this with the listeners?
Somewhere in every letter was the sentence, "This book does not fit into our plans." Of course it doesn't. It's an original idea. I thought of it and you didn't. It's not something that your market analyst told you there was a demand for. One person criticized it because the choices of paintings and sculptures were personal. Of course they're personal. If I cannot write about a thing with enthusiasm, how on earth would a reader get enthusiastic about
Right.
I didn't pay much attention to those reject letters.
Never, right? And when we first began to correspond about doing this interview, I just thought, oh my goodness, I teach art history to undergraduate students. How having a volume like this that brings many ideas together, but doesn't, force an overview, just brings so much together, will be so appealing for students of culture, art, humanity. And as we talked about at the beginning of the interview, the book is really to be digested over time. And that is a different project for 2017 for many people.
And I just finished struggling through an art history book that talks about modalities and reifications and all this gobbledygook. I have no idea what they're talking about.
Well,
You
this.
won't find that in my book.
No, I was going to say it's a refreshing part of the book. The book has much history. It has interesting pop culture history, and combined with the visual and of course your personal choices, it's a really different book that brings, I think, a lot of the best parts of art history and what art historians can do into a single project, and a project that you've spent much time on. And with that, would you tell us about your next project?
Okay, I mentioned I work with the gymnosophists. This was my dissertation topic. And I came upon them because my master's in interdisciplinary humanities was done at Wayne State University, which had not only a Western track but an Eastern track. And I knew I would never find that anywhere else. And so I took all these interdisciplinary courses on the cultures of India, China, Japan, Egypt. It was just wonderful, wonderful. The program no longer exists, and that's a terrible shame. But yes, I was ready then to go on for a doctorate. Well, the only good doctoral program I could find was at Florida State University, where they emphasized Greece and Rome. And I couldn't see a connection between that and what I had been doing. And then one day I ran across a reference to the Gymnosophists. I'd never heard of them before. I tried to look them up, found maybe 3 lines of footnote space, and that's all there was. And I said, there is my dissertation topic. It links India and Greece, deals with naked people. I'm not going to get bored. And it's been wonderful. Everybody else has had the good taste to leave that topic alone. I have it all to myself. I am the world's expert on the Gymnosophists. And so anyway, the book I'm doing is in two parts. The first half brings together everything that has ever been written about the Gymnosophists. And in some ways, it's telling the same story 91 different ways. But the last time anyone pulled these sources together was in the 1600s.
My gosh.
So it's time to do it again.
I would say so.
The second half of the book is my collected essays on the Gymnosophists, the Jains, the Buddhists, other Indian religions that have been published in very hard-to-find scholarly journals spread across four continents. And since I'm now of retirement age, it's time to bring all of those together in one volume. So that's what I'm working on now.
This sounds really exciting and important. And when we put both volumes together, there's just so much research there and passion and commitment to the subject.
Yeah, that one is more of a scholarly book. It'll sell to college libraries, where this one on the nude in art is of much more general interest.
Well, and will you remind everyone who is listening again how to purchase Art Follows Nature and with your website?
Yes, go to my website, paullevallee.com, and click the book link, and there are other links that will take you to a table of contents or sample pages, or better yet, an order blank.
Okay. Well, it's been really a pleasure to speak with you today, and I encourage everyone to get a copy of the book so you can really appreciate Dr. LaVallee's research and his point of view. And I guess that's a wrap.
Okay, I have thoroughly enjoyed this.
Thank you so much, and maybe we can have you on again when that second book is out.